fingers through the tangles in her hair. Wiping at his eyes, Torrent turned back to his horse, leaned his forehead against the slick coat of its neck. "I feel you, friend. You do not question your life. You are in its midst and know no other place, nothing outside it. How I envy you." She approached him, the faint crunch of stones underfoot, the slow pulse of her breathing. She came up on his left, reaching to stroke the horse in the softness between its nostrils, giving it her scent.
"Torrent," she whispered. "Who is out there?"
He grunted. "Your wolf ghosts are torn, aren't they? Curious, frightened."
"They smell death, and yet power. So much power."
The hide against his brow was now damp. "She calls herself a bonecaster, a shaman, a witch. Her name is Olar Athiel, and no life burns in her body."
"She comes before the dawn, 3 mornings in a row now, but draws no closer. She hides like a hare, and when the sun's light finally arrives, she vanishes like dust."
"Like dust," he agreed.
"What does she want?"
He stepped back from his horse, ran the back of one wrist against his brow, and looked away. "Nothing good, Setoc." She said nothing for a time, standing at his side, her furs wrapped tight about her shoulders. Then she seemed to shiver and said,
"A snake writhes in each of her hands, but they're laughing."
"Telerast, Curdle, they dance in my dreams. They're dead too. They're all dead, Setoc, but still they hunger for something." He shrugged. "We are all lost out here. I feel this like a rot in my bones."
"I told Gruntle of my visions, the wolves and the throne they guard. Do you know what he asked me?"
Torrent shook his head.
"He asked me if I've seen the wolves lift a leg against that throne."
He snorted a laugh, but the sound shook him in an unexpected way. "When did I last laugh, spirits below?"
"It's how they mark territory,"
Setoc went on, her tone wry.
"How they take possession of something. I was shocked, but not for long. They're beasts, after all. So what is it we worship when we worship them?"
"I worship no one anymore, Setoc."
"Gruntle says worship is nothing more than the surrender to things beyond our control. He says the comfort from that is false, because there is nothing comfortable in the struggle to live. He kneels to no one, not even his tiger of summer, who would dare compel him."
She hesitated and then sighed and added,
"I will miss Gruntle."
"He intends to leave us?"
"A 1,000 people can dream of war, but no 2 dreams are the same. Soon he will be gone, and Mappo too. The boy will be upset."
The 2 horses shied suddenly, stumbling in their hobbles. Stepping past them, Torrent scowled.
"This dawn," he said in a growl. "The hare is bold."
Precious Thimble bit back a shriek, clawed herself awake with a gasp. Traces of fire raced along her nerves. Kicking her bedding aside, she scrambled to her feet. Torrent and Setoc stood near the horses, facing north. Someone was coming. The ground underfoot seemed to recoil in waves sweeping past her, like ripples passing just beneath the surface. Precious struggled to slow her gasping breaths. She set out to join the warrior and the girl, leaning forward as if fighting an invisible current. Hearing heavy footfalls behind her, she glanced back to see Gruntle and Mappo.
"Be careful, Precious," Gruntle said. "Against this one."
He shook his head. The barbed tattoos covering his skin were visibly deepening, and in his eyes there was nothing human. He'd yet to draw his cutlasses. Her gaze flicked to the trail, but his expression revealed nothing.
"I didn't kill Jula. It wasn't my fault."
She spun back, pushed on. The figure striding towards them was withered, a crone swathed in snakeskins.
As she drew closer, Precious could see the ravaged state of her broad face, the emptiness of her eye sockets. Behind her, Gruntle unleashed a feline hiss.
Tlani Mas. No weapons, meaning she's a bonecaster. Precious Thimble, do not bargain with this one. She will offer you power to get what she wants. Refuse her.
Through gritted teeth, she replied,
We need to get home.
Not that way.
She shook her head. The crone halted 10 paces away, and to Precious Thimble's surprise, it was Torrent who spoke first.
Leave them alone, O Larathiel.
The hag cocked her head, wisps of hair drifting out like strands of spider silk.
There is only one, warrior. It is no concern of yours. I am here to claim my kin.
Your what? Which there's...
You cannot have him,
Gruntle rumbled, edging past Torrent.
Stay out of this, whelp,
Olarathiel warned.
Look to your god and see how he cowers before me.
She then pointed a gnarled finger at Mappo.
And you, Trell, this is not your battle. Stand aside, and I will tell you all you need know of the one you seek.
Mappo seemed to stagger, and then, his face twisting in anguish, he stepped back. Precious gasped. Setok spoke.
Who is this kin of yours, witch?
He is named Absi.
Absi? There is no...
The boy!
Snapped Olarathiel.
The son of Onos Tulan! Bring him to me!
Gruntle drew his swords.
Don't be a fool!
The bonecaster snarled.
Your own god will stop you. Treach will not simply let you throw away your life on this. You think to veer? You will fail. I will kill you, mortal sword. Do not doubt that. The boy, bring him to me.
The rest were awake now, and Precious turned round to see Absi standing between the twins, his eyes wide and bright. Balljag was slowly coming forward, closer to where Setok stood, its massive head lowered. Ambi Bol remained close to his brother's barrow, closed in and silent, his once young face now old, and whatever love there had been in his eyes had vanished. Cartographer stood with one foot in the coals of the hearth, staring at something to the east, perhaps the rising sun, while Sweetest Sufferance was helping faint to her feet.
I need to try some more healing on her. I can show Embi I don't always fail. I can... No, think about what is before us now. She gave Mappo what he wants, as easy as that. She bargains quick. She speaks true.
Precious faced the bonecaster.
Ancient one, we in the Trigal are stranded here. I have not the power to take us home. You will not interfere if I bless you with what you need?
Olarathiel nodded.
Agreed. Collect the child.
Don't even think it,
Gruntle warned, the look in his unhuman eyes halting Precious in her tracks. The barbs on his bared arms seemed to blur a moment, then grew sharp once again. The bonecaster said,
The boy is mine, whelp, because his father belongs to me. The first sword serves me once again. Would you truly desire to prevent me from reuniting the son with the father?
Stavian's story rushed closer, their questions tumbling together.
Father, he's alive? Where is he?
Gruntle barred their way with a leveled cutlass.
Hold a moment, you two. Something is not right here. Wait, I beg you. Guard your brother.
He turned back to Olarathiel.
If the boy's father now serves you, where is he?
Not far.
Then bring him to us, Gruntle said. He can collect his children himself.
The daughters are not of his blood,
Olarathiel replied.
I have no use for them.
You? What of Onos Tulan?
Give them to me, then, and I will see to their disposal.
Torrent spun round. Slitting their throats is what she means, Gruntle.
I did not say that, warrior,
the bonecaster retorted.
I will take the three. This I offer.
Balljag was edging closer to Olar Athiel, and she beckoned to it.
Blessed I greet you and invite you into my comp...
The huge beast lunged, massive jaws crunching as they closed round the bonecaster's right shoulder. The eye then spun, whipping Olar Athiel from her feet. Strips of reptile hide, fetishes of bone and shell flailed and snapped. The giant wolf did not release its grip, instead reared a second time, slamming Olar Athiel hard onto the ground. Bones splintered in its jaws, and the body struggled feebly, as would a victim stunned. Balljag tore loose its grip on her crushed shoulder and closed its fangs about her skull. It then whipped her into the air. Olar Athiel's left hand was suddenly stabbing into the eye's throat, punching through withered hide and closing on its spinal column. Even as the wolf flung her upward, she caught hold. The momentum from Balljag's surge added force to her grip. A sudden, terrible ripping sound erupted from the eye, and like a serpent, a length of the beast's spinal column tore free of its throat, still clutched in the witch's bony hand. The bonecaster spun away from the eye, landing hard in a clatter of bones. Balljag collapsed, head lolling like a stone in a sack. Absey wailed. As Olar Athiel was picking herself up, Gruntle marched towards her, his two weapons readied. Seeing him, she flung the spinal column to one side and began to veer. When he reached her, she was nothing but a blur, moments from expanding into something huge. He punched where her head had been a moment earlier, and the bell hilt of the cutlass cracked hard against something. The veering abruptly vanished. Reeling back, her face crushed, Olar Athiel sprawled on her back.
"Spit on the tiger god," Gruntle said, standing directly over her. "Who'd take your stupid veering and mine?"
Clashing his blades together, he brought them down in an X pattern beneath her jaw.
"Now, Bonecaster, I happen to know that if you hit even Tlanimas bones hard enough, they shatter."
"No, mortal!
Piss on that! I will leave you in pieces, do you understand me? Pieces! How's it done again? Head in a niche? On a pole? The crook of a tree? No trees here, witch, but a hole in the ground, that's easy."
"The child is mine."
"He won't have you."
"Why not?"
"You just killed his dog."
Precious Thimble hurried forward, feeling half-fevered, her knees wobbly beneath her.
"Bonecaster, I am considering withdrawing my offers," Olar Athiel said. "All of them. Now, mortal sword, will you remove your weapons and let me rise?"
"I haven't decided."
"What must I promise? To leave Absey in your care? Will you guard his life, mortal sword?"
Precious saw Gruntle hesitate.
"I came to bargain with you all," Olar Athiel continued. "In faith, the undead eye was a slave to ancient memories, ancient betrayals. I will not hold it against any of you. Mortal sword, look upon your friends. Who among them is capable of protecting the children? You will not. The Trell waits only to hear my words whispering through his mind, and then he will quit your company. The All-Warrior is a pup, and a disrespectful one at that. The Jag Boliad's spawn is broken inside. I mean to bring to Onos Tulan his children."
"He's a Tlani Mas, isn't he?"
The bonecaster was silent.
"It's the only way he would still serve you," Gruntle said. "He died just as his daughters believed, and you resurrected him. Will you do the same to the boy? The gift of your deathly touch?"
"Of course not. He must live."
"Why?"
She hesitated and then said,
Because he is the hope of my people, Mortal Sword. I need him for my army and for the first sword who commands them. The child Apsi shall be their cause, their reason to fight.
Gruntel, Precious Sore, was suddenly pale.
A child? Their cause?
Their banner, yes. You do not understand. I cannot hold on to his anger. The first swords. It is dark, a beast unchained, a leviathan. He must not be unleashed, not this way. Burns, dream, Mortal Sword, let me rise!
Gruntel withdrew his weapons, stumbled back a step. He was muttering something under his breath. Precious Thimble caught only a few words in the Daru tongue.
The banner, child's tunic, was that it? The color began red, ended black.
Olar Ethiel struggled to her feet. Her face was barely recognizable, a crushed, splintered knot of bone and torn hide. The gouges from Baljag's canines had scored deep white grooves on her temples and the base of her mandible on both sides. The ruined shoulder slumped, its arm hanging useless. As Gruntel backed still further, an anguished cry came from Setok.
Has she won you all, then? Will no one protect him? Please, please!
The twins were weeping. Absi was kneeling beside Baljag's desiccated body, moaning in a strange cadence. Cartographer clattered closer to the boy, one foot blackened and smouldering.
Make him stop that, someone. Make him stop that.
Precious frowned, but the others ignored the undead man's pleas.
What does he mean by that?
She turned to Olar Ethiel.
Bonecaster.
East, woman. That is where you will find all you need. I have touched your soul. I have made it into a mahib, a vessel that waits. East.
Precious Thimble crossed her arms, eyes closing for a moment. She wanted to look at Faint and Sweetest, to see the satisfaction, the relief in their eyes. She wanted to, but knew she would see nothing of the sort, not from those two. They were women, after all, and three children were being surrendered, thrown into undead arms.
They will thank me in the end, when the memory of this moment fades, when we are all safe and home again.
Well, not all of us, but what can we do? Setok, with Torrent at her side, was all that stood between Olar Ethiel and the three children. Tears streamed down Setok's cheeks, and in the all-warrior's stance, Precious Thimble saw a man facing his execution. He'd drawn his saber, but the look in his eyes was bleak. Yet he did not waver. Among them all, this young warrior was the only one not to turn away.
Damn you, Setok! Will you see this brave boy die? We can't stop her,
Precious said to Setok.
You must see that. Torrent, tell her.
I gave up the last of the all children to the Barghast, said Torrent. And now they are all dead. Gone.
He shook his head.
Can you protect these ones any better?
Precious demanded. It was as if he'd been slapped. He looked away.
Giving up children is the one thing I seem to do well.
He sheathed his weapon and grasped Setok's upper arm.
Come with me. We will talk where no one else can hear us.
Setok shot the warrior a wild look, started to struggle, and then abruptly sagged in his grip. Precious watched him drag her away.
He broke like a frail twig. Are you proud of yourself now, Precious? But the path is finally clear.
Olar Ethiel walked with a hitching gait she'd not shown before, joints grinding and snapping up to where the boy knelt. She reached down with her good arm and scooped him up by the collar of his Barghast tunic, held him out to study his face, and he in turn looked steadily back at her, dry-eyed, flat. The bonecaster grunted.
Your father's son, all right. By the abyss.
She turned round and set off, northward, the boy hanging from her grip. After a moment, the twins followed, neither one looking back.
There's no end to losing everything, is there? It just goes on and on. Their mother, their father, their people. No, they won't be looking back. And why should they? We've failed them. She came, she cut us apart, bought us like an empress scattering a handful of coins. And they were what she bought. Them and our turning away. And it was easy, because this is what we are. Mahaib? What in Hood's name is that?
With horror in his heart, Mappo set out from the camp, leaving the others, leaving behind this terrible dawn. He struggled to keep from breaking into a run, as if that would help. Besides, if they all watched him, they did so with consciences as stained as his own. Was there comfort in that? Should there be? We are nothing but our own needs. She but showed each of us the face we hide from ourselves and everyone else. She shamed us by exposing our truths. He fought to remind himself of his purpose, of all that his vow demanded, and the horrifying things it could make him do. Ikarium lives. Remember that. Focus on it. He waits for me. I will find him. I will make it all right once again. Our small world, closed up and impervious to everything outside it. A world where none will challenge us, where none will question our deeds, the hateful decisions we once made. Give me this world, please, I beg you. My most precious lies, she stole them all. They saw. Setok, dear gods, the betrayal in your face. No, I will find him. I will protect him from the world. I will protect the world from him. And from everything else, from hurt eyes and broken hearts. I will protect myself. And you all called it my sacrifice, my heartbreaking loyalty. There on the path of hands, I took your breaths away. Bonecaster, you stole my lies. See me now. He knew his ancestors were far, far away. Their bones crumbled to dust in chambers beneath heaped mounds of stone and earth. He knew he had forsaken them long ago. Then why could he hear their howls? Mappo clapped his hands over his ears, but that did not help. The howling went on and on. And on this vast, empty plain, he suddenly felt small, shrinking still further with each step. My heart, my honor, shrinking, withering down with each step. He's only a child. They all are. He curled up in Gruntle's arms. The girls, they held on to Setok's hands and sang songs. Is it not the one inescapable responsibility of an adult to protect and defend a child? I am not as I once was. What have I done? Memories. The past, all so precious. I want it back. I want it all back. Ikarium, I will find you. Ikarium, please, save me. Torrent climbed into his saddle. He looked down and met Setok's eyes and then nodded. He could see the fear and the doubt in her face and wished he had more words worth saying, but he'd used them all up. Was it not enough that he was doing this? The question, asked so boldly and self-righteously in his own mind, almost made him laugh out loud. Still, he had to do this. He had to try. I will ward them, I promise.
You owe them nothing,
she said, hugging herself with such severity he thought her ribs might crack.
Not your charge, but mine. Why do you do this?
I knew Tok.
Yes.
I think, what would he do? That is my answer, Setok. Tears ran down her face. She held her lips tight, as if to speak would be to loose her grief, a wailing demon that would never again be chained or beaten down. I left children to die once, he continued. I let Tok down. But this time, he shrugged, I hope to do better. Besides, she knows me. She will use me. She's done it before. He glanced over at the others. The camp was packed up. Faint and sweetest sufferance had already begun walking, like two broken refugees. Precious Thimble trailed them by a few steps, like a child uncertain of her welcome in their company. Amby walked on his own, off to the right of the others, staring straight ahead, his stride stiff, brittle. And Gruntle, after a few words with Cartographer, who once more sat on Jeweler's barrow, had set off, shoulders rounded as if in visceral pain. Cartographer, it seemed, was staying behind. It comes together only to fall apart. Setok, your wolf ghosts were frightened of her.
Terrified.
You could do nothing?
Her eyes flashed. Is that supposed to help? Words like that just dig big holes and invite us to jump.
He glanced away. I'm sorry.
Go, catch up to them.
He collected his reins, swung his mount round and tapped its flanks with his heels. Did you gamble on this too, Olar Ethel? How smug will you sound in your greeting? Well now, enjoy your time, because it won't last forever. Not if I have any say in the matter. Do not worry, Tok. I've not forgotten. For you I will do this, or die in the effort. He rode at a canter across the empty land, until he drew within sight of the Bonecaster and her three charges. When the twins turned and cried out in relief, it very nearly broke him. Setok had watched the young All-Warrior ride after Olar Ethel, saw when he reached them. An exchange of words, and then they set out once more, walking until the deceptive folds of the landscape swallowed them all. Then she turned, studied Cartographer.
The boy was crying in grief over his dead dog. You told him to stop. Why? Why should that have so bothered you?
How is it?
The undead man said, rising from the barrow and shuffling closer.
That the weakest among us is the only one so willing to give up his life protecting those children. I do not mean to wound you with my words, Setok. I but struggle to understand this.
The withered face tilted to one side, pitted eye sockets seeming to study her.
Is it perhaps because he has the least to lose?
He continued on in his awkward steps to stand over the carcass of the eye.
Of course he has, she snapped. As you said, just his life.
Cartographer looked down at the corpse of Baljag.
And this one had even less.
Go back to your dead world, will you? It's so much simpler there, I'm sure. You can stop wondering about the things us pathetic mortals get up to.
I am a knower of maps, Setok. Listen to my words. You cannot cross the glass desert. When you reach it, turn southward onto the South Elan. It is not much better, but there should be enough, at least to give you a chance.
Enough what? Food? Water? Hope? You are remaining here. Why?
In this place, Cartographer gestured, the world of the dead has arrived. Here, you are the unwelcome stranger.
Suddenly shaken, inexplicably distraught, Setok shook her head.
Gruntle said you were with them almost from the very beginning. Now you're just stopping.
Here? Must we all have a purpose?
Cartographer asked.
I did once, but that is done with.
His head turned, faced northward.
Your company was admirable, but I'd forgotten.
He hesitated, and she was about to ask what he'd forgotten when he said,
Things break.
Yes,
she whispered, not loud enough for him to hear. She reached down and collected the bundle of her gear. Straightening, she set out, then paused and glanced back at him.
Cartographer, what did Gruntle say to you at the barrow?
The past is a demon that not even death can shake.
What did he mean by that?
He shrugged, still studying Baljag's carcass.
I told him this. I have found the living in my dreams, and they are not well."
She turned away, began walking. Dust devils spun and raced along, tracking her on either side. Marsan Gilani knew all about this. She'd heard all the old stories of the Seven Cities campaign, how the Logros Tlanimas had a way of just vanishing, whispering on the winds or twisting along on the currents of some river. Easy for them, rising from the ground at the end of it all, not even out of breath. She snorted. Breath, that was a good one. Her horse was reluctant this morning. Not enough water, not enough forage, hadn't crapped or pissed in a day and a night. Wouldn't last much longer, she suspected, unless her companions could conjure up a spring and a heap of hay or a bag or two of oats. Could they do things like that? She had no idea. Be serious, woman. They looked as if a sleeping dragon had rolled over them. If they could magic stuff out of nowhere, well, they'd have done something by now. She was hungry and thirsty too, and if it came to it, she'd slit her horse's neck and feast until her belly exploded. Put that back together, will you? Thanks. Not far now. By her reckoning, she'd be on the Bone Hunter's trail before noon, and by dusk she'd have caught up with them. No army that size could move very quickly. They were carrying enough supplies to feed a decent-sized town for half a year. She glanced northward, something she found she was doing rather often of late. No surprise in that impulse, however. It wasn't every day that a mountain grew up out of nowhere in the course of a single day and night, and what a storm accompanied its birth. She thought to hitch to one side for a spit or two, to punctuate the sardonic wonder she'd just chewed on. But spit was worth keeping.
"Hold back one throatful," her mother used to say, "for hood's own face."
Bless her, the deranged fat cow. She must have given the ragged reaper a bubbly bath the day her time came, a hair wash, a cave mouth spring runoff of black stinking phlegm just gushing out, aye. Big women had a way, didn't they? Especially after their fourth or fifth decade, when all their opinions had turned to stone and chipped flinty enough to draw blood with a single glance or sneer. She'd moved like a tree, her mother had, and just as shocking to see, too. After all, trees don't walk much, not on a sober night, just like the earth didn't move unless Byrne was pitching or the man was better than he knew, and how rare was that? Loomed, old Ma did, like midnight thunder. Death was a crowded chamber for women like her, and the crowd was the kind that parted with her first step into the room. A miracle. Marsan Gilani wiped at her face, no sweat left. Bad news, especially this early in the morning. "I wanted to be big, Ma. I wanted to reach that ripe old age. 50, aye. 5 bitching, rutting, terror-inspiring decades. I wanted to loom. Thunder in my eyes, thunder in my voice, a thing of great weights and inexorable masses. It ain't fair, me withering away out here. Dalhon, do you miss me? The day I set foot on that grassy sward, the day I shoo the first mob of flies from my lips and nostrils and eyes, why, that's the day all will be right with the world once again. No, don't leave me to die here, Dalhon. It ain't fair." She coughed, squinted ahead. Something of a mess up there, those two rises, the valley sprawled in between. Holes in the ground. Craters. The slopes seemed to be swarming. She blinked, wondering if she was imagining that. Deprivation played nasty games, after all. Swarming. It was swarming, all right. Rats? No. Orthon. A field of battle. She caught the gleam of picked bones, took note of ashy mounds on the far ridge, from pyres, no doubt. Sound practice burning the dead, she knew. Kept disease to a minimum. She kicked her horse into a heavy canter. I know, not for long, sweetie. The dust devils whirled out past her now, spinning towards a ridge overlooking the valley. Marsan Gilani rode after them, to the top of the crest. There she reined in, scanning the wreckage filling the valley. and then the gaping entrenchments slashing across the opposite ridge, beyond which rose the humps of burned bones. Dread slowly seeped in, stealing all the day's heat from her bones. The Tlani mass of the unbound solidified in a rough line on her right, also studying the scene. Their sudden appearance after so many days of dust was strangely comforting to Masan Gilani. She'd only had her horse for company for far too long now.
"Not that I'll kiss any of you," she said.
Heads turned to regard her. None spoke.
"Thank God for that."
"My horse is dying," she announced, "and whatever happened here happened to my bone hunters, and it doesn't look good. So," she added, now glaring at the five undead warriors, "if you have any good news to tell me, or gods below any explanation at all, I really might kiss you."
The one named Baroque said,
"We can answer your horse's plight, human."
"Good," she snapped, dismounting. "Get to it, and a little water and grub for yours truly wouldn't go amiss either. I won't be eating Orthon anymore, just so you know. Whoever thought crossing a lizard with a rat was a good idea?"
One of the other Tlani Mas stepped out from the line. She couldn't recall this one's name, but it was bigger than the others and looked to be composed of body parts from three, maybe four, individuals.
"Kachain Naruk," it said in a low voice. "A battle and a harvest."
"Harvest?"
The creature pointed at the distant mounds.
"They butchered. They fed upon their fallen enemy."
Masan Gilani shivered.
"Cannibals?"
"The Naruk are not human."
"That makes a difference. To me, it's cannibalism. Only white-skinned barbarians from the Fen Mountains sink so low as to eat other people, or so I hear."
"They did not complete their feeding,"
said the oversized Tlani Mas.
"What do you mean?"
"See the newborn mountain to the north?"
"No," she drawled. "Never noticed it."
They all studied her again. Sighing, Masan said,
"Aye, the mountain, the storm."
"Another battle," said Baroque. "An Azath was born. From this, we conclude that the Naruk were defeated."
"Oh, we hit them a second time? Good."
"Kachain Chemal," said Baroque. "Civil war, Masan Gilani."
The warrior gestured with a twisted arm.
"Your army, I do not think they all died. Your commander..."
"Tavare's alive, then?"
"Her sword is."
"Her sword? Oh, that Utataral blade. Can I send you ahead? Can you find a trail if there is one?"
"Senik will scout the pass before us,"
Baroque said.
"It is a risk. Strangers would not welcome us."
"I can't imagine why."
Another protracted look. Then Baroque said,
"If our enemies should find us, Masan Gilani, before the moment of our final resurrection, then all we aspire to win will be lost."
"Win? Win what?"
"Why, our master's release."
She thought about asking a few more questions, decided against it.
"Gods below, you're not who I was sent to find, are you? Still, you wanted to find us, didn't you? Sinter, I wish you were here to explain what's going on. But my gut's telling me bad things. Your master? No, don't tell me. All right, let's ride clear of this, and then you feed us like you promised. But decent food, right? I'm civilized, Dalhonese, Malazan Empire. The emperor himself came from Dalhon."
"Masan Gilani," said Baroque, "we know nothing of this empire of which you speak."
The Tlani Mas warrior paused and then added,
"But the one who was once emperor, him we do know."
"Really? Before or after he died?"
The five Imas regarded her once more. Then Baroque asked,
"Masan Gilani, What is the relevance of that question?
She blinked and then slowly shook her head. None. None at all, I guess. Another Tlani Mas spoke now.
Mosongilani?
What?
Your old emperor.
What of him?
Was he a liar?
Masangilani scratched her head, and then she gathered up her reins, swung back onto her horse. That depends.
On what?
On whether you believe all the lies people say about him. Now let's get out of this, eat and get watered, and then find Tavare's sword. And if Opon's smiling down on us, she'll still be attached to it. She was startled when the five Imas bowed. Then they collapsed into dust and swirled away.
Where's the dignity in that? She wondered, and then looked out one more time over the battlefield and its seething Orthon.
Where's the dignity in anything, woman? For now, keep it all inside. You don't know what has happened here. You don't know anything for certain. Not yet. Just hold on. There's plenty of dignity in just holding on, the way Ma did. The smell of burning grass, wetness pressed against one cheek, cold air upon the other, the close sound of a click beetle. Sunlight filtered through shut lids, dusty air seeping into his lungs and then back out again. There were parts of him lying about, in pieces, or so it felt, but even the idea of it seemed impossible, so he discarded the notion despite what his senses were telling him. Thoughts, nice to find he was having them, a notable triumph. Now, if he could just pull his varied bits together, the ones that weren't there, but that could wait. First, he needed to find some memories. His grandmother. Well, an old woman, at least. Assumptions could be dangerous. One of her sayings, maybe. What about parents? What about them? Try to remember. How hard can that be? His parents. Not very bright, those two. Strange in their dullness. He'd always wondered if there wasn't more to them. There had to be, didn't there? Hidden interests, secret curiosities. Was Mother really that fascinated by what Widow Thirdly was wearing today? Was that the extent of her engagement with the world? The poor neighbour only owned two tunics and one ankle-length robe, after all, and pretty threadbare at that, as befitted a woman whose husband was a withered corpse in the sands of Seven Cities, and the death coin wasn't much to live by, was it? And that old man from down the street, the one trying to court her, well, he was just out of practice, that's all. Not worth your sneers, Mother. He's just doing his best, dreaming of a happier life, dreaming of waking something up in the widow's sad eyes. It's an empty world without hope. And if Father had a way of puttering about whistling some endless song and pausing every now and then to look distracted by a thought, if not thoroughly confused by its very existence, well, a man of decent years had plenty to think about, didn't he? It certainly looked like that. And if he had a way of ducking in crowds, of meeting no one's eyes, well, there was a world of men who'd forgotten how to be men. Or maybe they never learned in the first place. Were these his parents, or someone else's? Revelations landing with a thud. One, three, scores of them, a veritable landslide. How old had he been? 15? The streets of Jakarta suddenly narrowing before his eyes, the houses shrinking, the big men of the block dwindling to boastful midgets with puny eyes. There was a whole other world out there, somewhere. Grandma caught a glint in your eyes. You'd beaten the dust out of the gold carpet, rolled it out into my path. For these tender feet of mine, a whole other world out there, called learning, called knowledge, called magic. Roots and grubs and tied-off twists of someone's hair, small puppets and dolls with smeared faces of thread, webs of gut, bundles of shedding, the plucked backs of crows, etching on the clay floor, the drip-drip of sweat from the brow. Mud was effort. A taste on the tongue, that of grit from a licked stylus, and how the candles flickered and the shadows leapt.
Grandma, your gem of a boy tore himself apart. He had fangs in his flesh, and those fangs were his own, and round it went, biting, tearing, hissing in agony and fury, plummeting from the smoke-filled sky, lifting upward again, new wings, joints creaking, a sliding nightmare. You can't come back from that. You can't. I touched my own dull flesh, and it was buried under bodies, all that gore draining down. I was pickled in blood. That body, I mean. What used to be mine. You don't go back, not to that. Dead limbs shifting, slack faces turning, pretending to look at me. But I wasn't the one so rude as to drag them about. No need to accuse me with those blank eyes. Some fool's coming down here, and maybe my soaked skin feels warm, but that's all the lost heat from all these other corpses. I don't come back, not from that. Father, if you only knew the things I have seen. Mother, if only you'd opened your own heart, enough to bless that broken widow next door. Explain it to this fool, will you? It was a mound of bodies. They'd gathered us. Friend, you weren't supposed to interfere. Maybe they ignored you, though I can't figure why. And your touch was cold. Gods, it was cold. Rats, nuzzling close, they'd snatched fragments of me out of the air. In a world where everyone is a soldier, the ones underfoot don't get noticed. But even ants fight like fiends. My rats, they worked hard, warm bodies like nests. They couldn't get all of me. That wasn't possible. Maybe you pulled me out, but I was incomplete. Or not. Grandma, someone tied strings to me. With everything coming down all around us, he'd knotted strings to my hood-damned rats. Oh, clever bastard, quick. Clever, clever bastard. All there, all here, I'm all here. And then someone dug me out, carried me away. And the short tails looked over every now and then, milled as if contemplating taking objection, but never did. He carried me away, melting as he went. All the butchering going on. They had a way of puttering about, whistling some endless song and pausing every now and then to look distracted by a thought, if not thoroughly confused by its very existence. Like that. So he carried me away. And where was everybody? The pieces were back together, and Bottle opened his eyes. He was lying on the ground, the sun low to the horizon, dew in the yellow grasses close to his face, smelling of the night just past. Morning. He sighed, slowly sat up, his body feeling crazed with cracks. He looked across at the man crouched near a dung fire. His touch was cold, and then he melted. Captain Ruthen Gud, sir. The man glanced over, nodded, resumed combing his beard with his fingers.
It's a bird, I think.
Sir?
He gestured at the rounded lump of scorched meat skewered above the embers.
Just sort of fell out of the sky. Had feathers, but they've burned off.
He shook his head.
Had teeth, too, however. Bird, lizard, it's an even handful of straws in each hand, as the strike used to say.
We're alone.
For now. We've not been gaining on them much. You start getting heavy after a while.
Sir, you have been carrying me?
Melting. Drip, drip.
How far? How many days?
Carrying you? What am I, a Toblakai? No, there's a travoy behind you. Dragging's easier than carrying, somewhat. Wish I had a dog. When I was a child, well, let's just say that wishing I had a dog has been an unfamiliar experience. But yesterday I'd have cut a god's throat for one single dog.
I can walk now, sir.
But can you pull that travoy?
Frowning, Bottle twisted and looked at the conveyance. Two full-length spear shafts, the pieces of two or three others, webbing from the harnesses of leather armor. The strips stained black.
Nothing to pull in it, sir, that I can see.
I was thinking me, Marine.
Well, I can... Ruthen picked up the spit and waved it about.
A joke, soldier. Ha ha. Here, this thing looks ready. Cooking is the process of making the familiar unrecognizable and thus palatable. When intelligence was first born, the first question asked was, can this thing be cooked? After all, try eating a cow's face. Well, true enough, people do. Oh, never mind. You must be hungry.
Bottle made his way over. Ruthen plucked the bird from the skewer and then tore it in half, handing one section to the marine. They ate without conversation. At last, sucking and spitting out the last bone, licking grease from his fingers, Bottle sighed and eyed the man opposite him.
I saw you go down, sir, under about 100 short tails.
Ruthen raked his beard.
Aye.
Bottle glanced away, tried again.
Figured you were dead.
Couldn't get through the armor, but I'm still a mass of bruises. Anyway, they pounded me into the ground for a while and then just, well, gave up.
He grimaced.
Took me some time to dig free. By then, apart from the dead they were collecting, there was no sign of the bone hunters or our allies. The Kundril looked finished, never saw so many dead horses, and the trenches had been overrun. The Lethary had delivered and taken some damage, but hard to guess the extent of either.
I think I saw some of that, Bottle said.
I sniffed you out, though,
the captain said, not meeting Bottle's eyes.
How?
I just did. You were barely there, but enough, so I pulled you free.
And they just watched.
Did they? Never noticed that.
He wiped his hands on his thighs and rose.
Ready to walk then, soldier?
I think so. Where are we going, sir?
To find the ones still left.
When was the battle?
4 or 5 days ago, something like that.
Sir, are you a storm rider?
A rogue wave?
Bottle's frown deepened.
Another joke, said Ruthen Gud. Let's strip what's on the travoy. Found you a sword, a few other things you might find useful.
It was all a mistake, wasn't it?
The man shot him a look.
Everything is, soldier, sooner or later.
Chaos foamed in a thrashing maelstrom far below. He stood close to the ledge, looking down. Off to his right, the rock tilted, marking the end of the vaguely level base of the pinnacle, and at the far end, the spar, a gnarled thing of black stabbing upward like a giant finger, seemed to cast a penumbra of white mist from its ragged tip. Eventually, he turned away, crossed the flat stretch, 12 paces to a sheer wall of rock, and to the mouth of a tunnel where shattered boulders had spilled out to the sides. He clambered over the nearest heap until he found a dusty oilskin cape jammed inside a crevasse. Tugging it aside, he reached down and withdrew a tattered satchel. It was so rotted, the base began splitting at the seams, and he scrambled quickly to flat ground before the contents spilled out. Coins pattered, baubles struck and clattered. 2 larger items, both wrapped in skins and each the length of a man's forearm, struck the bedrock but made no sound. These objects were the only ones he collected, tucking one into his belt and unwrapping the other. A scepter of plain black wood, its ends capped in tarnished silver. He examined it for a moment and then strode to the base of the spar of Andi. Rummaging in the pouch at his hip, he withdrew a knotted clutch of horsehair, dropped it at his feet, and then with a broad sweeping motion used the scepter to inscribe a circle above the black stone. Then he stepped back. After a moment, his breath caught and he half turned. When he spoke, his tone was apologetic.
Ah, mother, it's old blood, I don't deny it. Old and thin.
He hesitated and then said,
tell father I make no apologies for my choice. Why should I? No matter. The two of us did the best I could.
He grunted in humor.
And you might say the same thing.
He turned back. Darkness was knotting into something solid before him. He watched it for a time, saying nothing, although her presence was palpable, vast in the gloom behind him.
If he'd wanted blind obedience, he should have kept me chained. And you, mother, you should have kept me a child forever, there under your wing.
He sighed, somewhat shakily.
We're still here, but then we did what you both wanted. We almost got them all. The one thing none of us expected was how it would change us.
He glanced back again, momentarily.
And it has.
Within the circle before him, the dark form opened crimson eyes. Hoofs cracked like iron axe blades on the stone. He grasped the apparition's midnight mane and swung onto the beast's back.
Where your child, mother?
He drew the horse round, walked it along the ledge a few strides, and then back to the mouth of the tunnel.
I've been among them for so long now. What you gave me is the barest whisper in the back of my soul. You offered scant regard for humans, and now it's all coming down. But I give you this.
He swung the horse round.
Now it's our turn. Your son opened the way, and as for his son, well, if he wants the scepter, he'll have to come and take it.
Ben Edifon Delat tightened his grip on the horse's mane.
You do your part, mother. Let father do his, if he's of a mind to. But it comes down to us. So stand back, shield your eyes, because I swear to you, we will blaze. When our backs are against the wall, mother, you have no idea what we can do.
He drove his heels into the horse's flanks. The creature surged forward.
Now, sweet haunt, this could get a little hairy.
The horse reached the ledge, then out into the air, and down, plunging into the seething maelstrom. The presence, breathing darkness, remained in the vast chamber for a time longer. The strewn scatter of coins and baubles glittered on the black stone. Then came a tapping of a cane upon rock. Chapter 3. Time now to go out into the cold night. And that voice was chill enough to awaken me to stillness. There were cries inviting me into the sky, but the ground held me fast. Well, that was long ago now. Yet in this bleak morning, the wings are shadows hunched on my shoulders, and the stars feel closer than ever before. The time is soon, I fear, to set out in search of that voice, and I will draw to the verge. Time now to go out into the cold night. Spoken in so weary a tone, I can make nothing worthy from it. If dreams of flying are the last hope of freedom, I will pray for wings with my last breath. Cold Night, Beleaguer. Smoke hung in thick wreaths in the cabin. The portholes were all open, shutters locked back. But the air did not stir, and the sweltering heat lapped exposed flesh like a fevered tongue. Clearing her throat against a pervasive itchiness in her upper chest, Thalash, 14th daughter of Queen Abrastal, tilted her head back on the soft, if soiled and damp, pillow. Her handmaid set about refilling the pipe bowl.
Are you certain of the date?
Thalash asked.
Yes, Highness.
Well, I suppose I should be excited. I made it to my 15th year. Let the banners wave. Not that anything waves hereabouts.
She closed her eyes for a moment and then blinked them open again.
Was that a swell?
I felt nothing, Highness.
It's the heat I don't appreciate. It distracts. It whispers of mortality, yielding both despondency and a strange impatience. If I'm to die soon, I say, let's just get on with it.
Mild congestion, Highness.
And the sore lower back?
Lack of exercise.
Dry throat?
Allergies.
All these aches everywhere?
Highness, said the handmaid, are there moments when all these symptoms simply vanish?
Orgasm. Or if I find myself, suddenly busy.
The handmaid drew the water pipe to life and handed the princess the mouthpiece. Fellash eyed the silver spigot.
When did I start this?
The rust leaf, Highness. You were 6.
And why, again?
It was that or chewing your fingernails down to nothing, as I recall, Highness.
Ah, yes. Childish habits. Thank the gods I'm cured. Now, do you think I dare the deck? I swear I felt a swell back then, which must yield optimism.
The situation is dire, Highness, the handmaid said. The crew is weary from working the pumps, and still we list badly. No land in sight, not a breath of wind. There is a very serious risk of sinking.
We had no choice, did we?
The captain and first mate do not agree with that assessment, Highness. Lives were lost. We are barely afloat.
Male's fault,
Fellash snapped.
Never known the bastard to be so hungry.
Highness, we have never before struck such a bargain with an elder god.
And never again. But Mother heard, didn't she?
She did.
How can that not be worth the sacrifices?
The handmaid said nothing, sitting back and assuming a meditative pose. Fellash studied the older woman with narrowed eyes.
Fine. Opinions differ. Have cooler heads finally prevailed?
I cannot say, Highness. Shall I?
No. As you said, exercise will do me good. Select for me a worthy outfit, something both lithe and flaunting, as befits my sudden maturity. 15! Gods, the slide has begun.
Her first mate, Shurkalal saw, was having trouble managing the canted deck. Not enough sound body parts, she assumed, to warrant much confidence, but for all his awkwardness, he moved quickly enough, despite the winces and flinches with every step he took. Pain was not a pleasant thing to live with, not day after day, night upon night, not with every damned breath.
I do admire you, Squoggin.
He squinted up at her as he arrived on the poop deck.
Captain?
You take it with a grimace and not much else. There are many forms of courage, I believe, most of which pass unseen by the majority of us. It's not always about facing death, is it? Sometimes it's about facing life.
If you say so, Captain.
What do you have to report? She asked.
We're sinking.
Well, she'd imagined she'd float for a while, and then eventually wander down, like a bloated sack of sodden herbs, until she found the sea bottom. Then it would be walking, but where?
North, I think.
Captain?
The undying gratitude surely deserves a better fate. Provision the launches. How long do we have?
Hard to say.
Why?
Scorgon's good eyes squinted.
What I meant was, I don't like saying it. Bad luck, right?
Squoggin, do I need to pack my trunk?
You're taking your trunk? Will it float? I mean, if we tie it behind the lifeboat, we only got 2 that'll float and both are a bit battered. 29 left in the crew, plus you and me and our guests. 10 in a launch and we'll be awash at the first whitecap. I ain't good at numbers, but I think we're off some. Could be people holding on in the water. But not for long, with all those sharks hanging around. Ideal is 8 to a boat. We should get down to that quick enough. But your trunk, well, that messes up my figuring.
Squoggin, do you recall loading my trunk?
No.
That's because I don't have one. It was a figure of speech.
That's a relief, then. Besides, he added, you probably wouldn't have the time to pack it anyway. We could roll in the next breath or so, I'm told.
Erin, take me. Get our guests up here.
He pointed behind her.
There's the well-born one just coming up, Captain. She'll float high in the water, that she will, until the...
Lower the launches and round up the crew, Squoggin.
Shurk said, stepping past him and making her way to the princess.
Ah, Captain, I really must...
No time, Highness. Get your handmaiden and whatever clothes you'll need to stay warm.
The ship is going down, and we need to get to the launches. Blinking owlishly, Falash looked round.
That seems rather extreme.
Does it?